Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, the microphone is approximately 3 feet away from me, lying on a flat surface, a little below the level of my mouth. I'm speaking in a normal conversational tone, testing, 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 1, 2, 3, testing, testing. Often with, when you're trying to do union histories, it's very difficult to come up with the original materials.
But as I understand, Maury has. Yes.
Well, that's great if he's got them. It wouldn't get him to donate, you know,
well,
to the
sure
projects that
sure
end up in the library.
Sure,
because I see that, it seems to me that, you know, besides the book, that one of the important things that I think you mentioned is just to get this stuff all in one place and safely store it away.
And then what the longshoreman would like to do is about every 10 years review it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and add to it.
Add a
and,
chapter.
And if we could just prevail upon this group of longshoremen to have historians. I mean, just like that clipping I gave you now, I know that the union hasn't written.
Mm-hmm.
And there's clippings that have been there every week that are of value.
Yeah. Yeah, just even a newspaper clipping book.
Mm-hmm.
How do you spell your last name, just so I...
T-H-R-O-N-S-O-N.
T-H-R-O-N-S-O-N. Oh, okay. I've been putting an E-N for some reason. Was there anything that you particularly wanted, you know, to say that I haven't asked about or covered? Or now, what I'll probably want to do is as I, you know, get into the 1934 strike and stuff like that, you know, sorting out the details of dates when things happened and the names of the
mm-hmm.
people who did it and stuff, I will probably want to come back, you know, and sort of go over, you know, more real details of, you know, sort of events as they happened.
Well, just like that, the strike in 1934 had been set for 8 o'clock on the 9th of May. On the 7th of May, we discovered in Tacoma that Seattle hadn't voted to out on strike. You can imagine that.
They just overlooked it?
No, they didn't want to.
Oh.
So we got a hold of the president of the Seattle local, which was named, his name was Erickson, and said, can you arrange a meeting for the night of the 8th of May and get everybody there and we'll come over. So they arranged a meeting in a garage in Seattle, down there off on First Avenue or below the old hall. And there was Patty Morris and Big Ed Harris, myself, Andy Larson, there was quite a few of us, Miller, we all went over and addressed this meeting. And we told them what we thought and rabble-roused and did everything we could. And then the men started to leave, and there still wasn't a vote to go out on strike. So the president of the union, Mr. Erickson, he locked the doors until we could get a vote. And finally, at midnight, we got the Seattle longshoremen to agree that they would strike the following morning. No
why didn't
guts.
They want to go out?
No guts.
They thought they'd lose?
Well, certainly. So then they went out on strike on the 9th of May with the rest of us, and then by the we discovered that 11th of May there's 2,000 scabs working in Seattle. All the ships are working. They're working at the Smith Cove and every place else. So then we've put out word for the longshoremen in Tacoma in the morning of the 12th of May to come down to the hall at 5 o'clock in the morning. And we got trucks and everything else and went to Seattle and cleared the docks. Threw the scabs in the water and we did everything else and then went up and told the Seattle longshoremen, okay, you know, now you take care of it. Well, that's the situation we found. There's lots of stories to tell about the 34 strike. And that's the thing that amazes me is that the history that's being written, the next generation, they're just going to be brainwashed. They won't realize that what their parent local right here in Tacoma did. I mean, they didn't have to do that, but they did it to save themselves and to save Seattle. Why hasn't Seattle come out and said we sat on our butts? To hear them talk, you think that they were the big heroes of the thing, that they tied up to the Pacific Coast. They didn't even tie up their own port until they were shown how to do it.
Now, during the 34th strike, Tacoma worked, had a special agreement to work the Alaska.
Right. That agreement, in other words, the ships were started to work in Seattle. And for some...
Wasn't it the Smith's Cove? Wasn't it Alaska trade?
Right, and the longshoremen said, no, we're not going to work Smith Cove, because the police had been in there with tear gas and whatnot. And so then the only other thing said, okay, let's bring it to Tacoma, where we've got a port there that hasn't...
Now, what was so crucial about working Alaska trade? I mean, what I know they used the rationalization, well, everybody in Alaska's going to starve if you don't do it. Was that a rationalization to get people to work it, or was that a real possibility?
Well, they claimed it was a possibility.
And there was sort of no way to check whether it was true or not.
Well, we did more or less check the cargo to see.
Make sure it was really food, medicine, and stuff. Yeah.
So it worked out all right. And then in turn, the people that worked it, I mean, you would bring gangs in from Seattle and Everett and every place else. And the longshoreman, he would get half of the wages and his union would get the other half. So we did two things. The union treasury got a little better, and the union man, he got to pay a bill, because there was no strike for him, so there was nothing, there was no. The only way you could get by was the best way you could. A lot of men went into that strike probably with $10 or $20. It was tough. But it was the summertime, that was. You had a garden, you could do something. And that's why we always believed that contracts should expire in the spring, not in September. When you go into the winter months, I mean, that's crazy. Because the spring is when there is a rush, freight and all the rest of it. Why put yourself on the bricks when you're fighting snowballs?
Well, of course, when I was working at UPS, we always fought for contract expiration of November 1st, because their busiest time of year was Christmas. We wanted to hit them when they were.
And that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
But when you talk to the rest of them, they'll, they can elaborate on a lot of these things. But there's a lot in the newspapers too, just like on that 12th of May. I mean, Jesus, the newspapers, they in Seattle particularly, what the hell is this? I mean, this is a revolution. I mean, here's rank outsiders come over and doing this sort of thing. They certainly weren't sympathetic to this. But in turn...
Newspapers seldom are.
Sure. But in turn, you know, how nice it would have been if the longshoremen had kept a scrapbook.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have two scrapbooks that the PMA kept for the 34 strike. A lot of stuff out of the PI and the Times and the News Tribune, all kinds of clippings.
See,
and stuff.
During the time of the 34, we had the Waterfront Employers of Washington, you know, for a long time, and then they. When the strike was coming, then they made that group, the Pacific Maritime Association. They could see the longshoremen and others that it was going to take a coastwise effort to do that. So if you get talking to the associate, Mr. Shields, he's the manager over there now, and he's real nice. Talk to Shields, and I'm sure that he would give you the old information out of the old Waterfront Employers of Washington. That was their first. Yeah, Shields was a real nice guy.
What's his first name?
Jesus, I don't know. I forgot.
All right, okay.
Marie, but he's a manager over there. So he's
did you have any questions, Marie? Anything you wanted to ask?
Well, should I sit over there so that the microphone will pick up what you're saying?
Here, maybe scoot this up a little so that you can...
I'm concentrating my research on the ethnic groups,
mm-hmm.
on the various nationalities on the waterfront. And first of all, when does your memory start of the waterfront and the union?
Well, of course, when I joined.
And when was that, 27?
Yeah, that was 27 when I first appeared.
27.
So the rest of it is by my curiosity and what the old timers told me.
But you grew up in Tacoma.
I grew up in Tacoma.
Was your neighborhood Scandinavian or Norwegian?
No.
Well, we're interested in all the ethnic groups in Tacoma, and it'd be Scandinavians, Germans.
Well, of course, we had Norwegians were predominant of the Scandinavians. Then we had Swedes and Danes and Finns.
And they lived not in districts, but all over town.
They lived all over town. In turn, that would be our Scandinavian group. Then, in turn, we had lots of Germans. We had a few Hollanders. We had a few Frenchmen. We had Italians. Of course, we had the colored. We had Irish. We had English. Jeez, I don't remember any Scotchmen.
You said we had. Do you mean on the waterfront?
Yeah,
you're talking about on the waterfront.
Yeah, we're just on the waterfront. I don't remember any. Yeah, we had Scotchmen. Yeah, the Scottish here. So we had a pretty good. We had Indians and colored, Tahitians, we had Hawaiians, Australians. I think we had a pretty good breakdown of all of them. The majority of them that came on the waterfront with the age group we had drifted onto the waterfront from other unions that had suffered strikes, like the mine workers. You know, when they would be broke, why then they would gyrate to work opportunities, and they would come down good workers, of course. And the Western Federation of Miners, they had a terrific beating down in Bixby, Colorado, and those places, and some of those showed up here on the waterfront. We were very receptive.
I think that's one of the things that helped Tacoma stay union, is there was just a union consciousness among the distressed people.
The distressed labor people. Like Bob Harden, who became a great leader in our union here. He was out of the Butte mines and had been run out of Butte. And he was next Wobbly, of course. He was still a Wobbly. But after the organization on the Pacific Coast, was an international vice president.
Of the ILA.
Of the ILA, see. Very anti-Bridges. And he was a Tacoma man, and he came. So a lot of those, Ed LaBelle, the Frenchman, he came out of the Western Federation of Miners. And there was men out of the copper mines in Michigan. But I think that was where the strength of the union came. And of course, a lot of the Scandinavians were ex-union seamen. And the Irish the same way. There were a lot of ex. It seemed to me there was a lot of union seamen out of Great Britain, more so than out of the United States. But it was the age group that fascinated me when you got to working, and you'd be working with men as your partner that was, my God, they were old. They were 60 and 65 years old, you know, working. I remember one fellow that I used to enjoy working with, his name was Jack Manners. He was about 6'4" and a big husky guy. He had been an IWW and wound up in Tacoma. He got married when he was 40. And so here he is, 65, and he had two young daughters. They were 22, 23, And in turn, I love to work with Jack, so one of the trips I made to see when I came back after I was here a short while, I said, geez, I haven't seen Jack. Where's Jack? And they said, well, didn't you hear what happened to him? And I said, no. Well, Jack thought he had piles, and that was very prevalent on the waterfront through lifting and straining.
That and hurting.
Yeah, and he thought he had piles and kind of find out he had cancer. And I said, well, is he home or what is he? He said, oh, no. And I said, well, what happened? Well, Jack had a little home paid for out on McKinley Hill. He had a wife and these two young daughters, and he had about $4,000 saved. And so he wasn't going to spend that for a doctor bill. He went down, they bought himself a $2 revolver, took a bath and put on clean underwear, laid down papers and went out in the woodshed and shot himself. Lots of guns.
Well, there wasn't any hope for cancer in those days.
Yeah, see, I mean, that was my old friend Jack Manners.
No pensions or...
No, there was no nothing, see? So he had a decision and he made it, and that was his answer to it. He did it.
Did you see that was characteristic of a lot of the longshoremen that they...
Well, I think it was characteristic of the times. I mean, you provided for yourself. In other words, it seemed to me that what everybody was striving for was a little security. And their security consisted of you get a house, just a little ordinary house with about 6 lots and a few fruit trees, and you could get a chicken coop.
How much would you pay for
coop.
Something like that, a little house with some room?
Well, you could do that pretty well if you didn't want to get too close to the streetcar. You could probably do that for $1,500, $1,600. Of course, the key.
And you were making how much a year?
Well,
usually.
When I first got married, which was in 1931, my first yearly income was $600. When I rent an apartment, it was $12. Mm-hmm. So you made it. I mean, but everybody felt that you had to supplement your income. There was just no other way of doing it. You had to do it through a garden, or maybe you fished, or you did something else. You didn't.
So that's where you get some of these nicknames, clam digger and clam yes, rancher and hog rancher and chicken rancher.
Yes,
they go home from work and work on their little farm.
Mm-hmm. And it was that was one of the reasons why they found it so attractive in this area, that land was cheap. And of course you could start out small. I mean, you didn't need to start out with a house with a basement. You could start out with a good size woodshed. And just start that way and then build. And a lot of guys packed lumber home. They did all kinds of things. Raised a family, but nobody wanted their kids on the waterfront. They figured, well, there's something better. Now it's the reverse.
Because now you've got the union and there's security on
That's
the waterfront, right?
Well, plus high yes. wages.
Yeah.
You know, people wouldn't believe that. Well, I guess some of these longshoremen are making $40,000 a year. Well, that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of overtime, too.
Well, of course, it doesn't take so much overtime. You got an 8-hour guarantee.
Yeah.
And they can work 11 shifts in a week. Well, that takes some figuring when you figure there's only 7 days to get 11 days out of it.
Yeah.
But it's
been... You're working around the clock, aren't you?
Well, not necessarily. See, if you...
And you have choice, a
see,
certain amount
you
of choice.
Choice. In other words, if you're a skilled crane driver and they need a crane on a ship to make one lift, they got to pay 8 hours. So maybe that one lift is at 8 o'clock. You know, say that you can do that twice in a day. Maybe you go up the hall and at noon somebody else wants a lift. So there you've got 16 hours pay. How long have you worked? 2 hours. You certainly are still fresh, so you can line up at 5 o'clock. And it doesn't take very long. But that doesn't happen all the time, of course.
And for the guy who doesn't want to work like that, he can just work his 5 days
That's right.
and do all right.
Sure.
These nationalities that you mentioned on the waterfront, were they in mixed gangs?
Oh, yes.
And they all work
mixed,
together all
they
right?
They all work together, no problems.
No problems with the Indians or blacks or anything? Mm-hmm.
Well, in the first place, they had passed on him before he could become in the Union. Grieved that he was going to be a brother. And of course, when you joined the union, you took your pledge, and the only rights that you had was to pay dues and the right to line up in the hall, but they didn't guarantee you a job. So you could be a union member, and if you didn't do your work, well, then you just slowly have to find yourself some other industry.
I just remembered something. In the 20s, before the Joint Labor Relations Committee thing was set up through the contract, how were grievances handled? Was there something similar to the Labor Relations Committee?
There always was an employer-employee committee. But most of the grievances in Tacoma were handled right on the job. I mean, you could have a grievance, you get the business agent down, you'd settle it. In other words, it wasn't a long, drawn-out thing, and it wasn't a complicated thing. I mean, it never was minor. You know, all these little minor things that ties up ships, it never happened. It'd be a fact that you felt that the gear was such that it wasn't rigged properly, or maybe one of the officials were asking you to do something you felt wasn't right. Well, you generally continued the job until the business agent. Of course, the business agent would be down there immediately. It would be settled.
Doesn't that relationship sort of in general depends, though, on the balance of power? I mean, the employers are really strong. They'll tend to see all grievances as an opportunity to further beat the union down.
Well, in those days you were dealing more closely with your direct employer. Now you're under this setup today, you're removed from your employer. You know, you have your lawyers and your labor relations committees and all the rest of it. So you get so damn involved now that you don't have that close relationship. And that's what Tacoma has tried to keep, is a close relationship, and attempting to keep the grievances that you could settle on the job. And if you'll notice this business agent they have up there now, and if you have a talk with him, his dad was quite a longshoreman. I worked many and many a shift with him. And he certainly has the work ethic ingrained in his kids, because both of them, which are on the waterfront, are workers, and they believe that you should work, and this business agent, he believes that the men should work too, but work under certain conditions, I mean union conditions, safe conditions, and he's out of bed all hours of the day and night to settle the beef, take care of it on the job. And I think that's, you should talk to Guinness, you should talk to those business agents prior to Ingalls, another one. And Ingalls was there when Perry first came and developed the Perry relationship. They've had good, strong business agents. Not college.
That's a full-time paid staff position, that and dispatchers.
That's right.
Now, stewards, you have job stewards? You don't, just the business agent acts as your steward going from...
Each guy is his own steward, which is the way it should be.
You said that that in the union, all the nationalities considered each other like brothers because they had to vote on each other. What about as permit men?
Well, the permit men, of course, they in turn, they didn't have anything to say. And they were there. That was the first step up the rung, and they realized that. And when they sat in those chairs, they couldn't even... shake, if they shook their head at a hatch tender, no, I won't work with you on that particular job, they knew that they were just cutting their own throat, because they were going to have to prove themselves that they could do the work.
Did the hatch tender tend to choose his own nationality or nationality of his own? Nationality didn't have nothing to do with the selection of a job?
Same way with it. We had colored hatch tenders. They didn't pick all colored. Pick whoever they felt like picking, so the gang would be maybe basically colored, but there was white in the gang, and it wouldn't be the same ones. It would be different ones on different occasions and different ships. If you wanted to line up for the colored gang, you could line up, and you had the same chance as anyone else.
Yeah.
Now, I worked with Wolf Larsen, and Wolf Larsen was Norwegian, and in turn, the gang was a log gang, and when we would go on to pulp, many times Wolf would pick Barney Rucker to fill in. I would partner with Barney Rucker. In fact, I liked to work with Barney. So here would be a gang with predominantly Scandinavian or Finn, and here would be Barney in there, which was all right. Nobody thought anything of it. Just.
Is because they liked him and he was
well,
a good worker.
Well, he was worker, good worker.
But the gang was primarily Finn?
Oh, Scandinavian.
Or Scandinavian. Were other gangs primarily Irish?
Oh, yeah, there was gangs that, one gang in particular, Paddy Doyle, he tended to have a few Irishmen in it. Now, Herman Free, she had one Irishman. It wasn't, they were scattered around pretty well.
Did he choose a lot of Germans?
No.
No.
Pretty well. He had the Danes and had a little of everything in there, Frenchmen.
Did the, any of the different, did any nationality have trouble becoming permit men?
No. The only people that would, I would say would have trouble becoming permit men was somebody who didn't want to work. If you, that was the first qualification.
Were there any Asian people?
No, there was. Tacoma, as such, they kind of looked frowned on Asian people. They'd run them out of town here years before, and there was very, very few. What few there was, they either had a laundry or a chop suey joint.
So they still felt that way about them, even in the 20s, even Filipinos and Polynesian people, although Tahitians and Hawaiians were okay.
Because they look at the size of them.
Yeah.
You know, they could certainly do the work.
Did small men have trouble getting work on the waterfront, or were they
No, they didn't, but the small men that were on the waterfront were certainly pretty skookum. And there was a lot of small ones, too.
Well, Martin Peterson and Lee Barker, too, are the guys I've talked to, and they're short and wiry.
But they were pretty skookum guys. But you didn't come down on the waterfront unless you figured you could cut the mustard, you know. Because, by reputation, even today, they consider it, the average person considers it real hard work. Well, not today under this.
Yeah, I've got machines to do most of it now.
Does any one nationality predominate in the Union? Were it more Norwegians because there are more Norwegians here, but did they dominate in the Union or Germans?
I don't think so.
You think nationality had really very little to do with the longshoremen?
I think your own natural ability had a great deal to do with it. And I think that if they figured that you could not only do the work, but if you had a level head on you, they'd listen. They'd listen. But you first had to be able to do the work. That was the first qualification. Now, have you noticed that with Green?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something a little bit in just in passing. Maybe you'd like to talk a little bit more about it. You're saying that the Irish predominated in the coal work with the shovel. Did any other nationalities predominate in different kinds of cargo?
I think that by and large, the log gangs were primarily Scandinavians, because that was a peavey job, you know. It was real tough, pulling the bull winches, and the hatch tenders were on the log ships, which were preferred gangs. They only had about three of them, and that was Casperson, Wolf Larsen. There was one other, but there was a lot of Scandinavian in those guys.
Do you think it's because they knew that from Norway?
No, No, they would get big and strong.
These nationalities that worked on the waterfront, were they born in this country or are they largely immigrants?
No, most of them were first citizens.
They were immigrants?
Immigrants. Jumped ship, many, many of them.
What kind of language problems did that create?
Well, it didn't seem to create any.
Well, some either had already picked up English or picked it up.
That's why by the time I come here, they all could speak English. Of course, I think in the old country, most of them, what little schooling they did have, where English is predominant too. But they didn't have much. So there was a lot of Scandinavians that would speak to one another, and sometimes all day long. In some of those gangs, you wouldn't hear a word of English. But it was just not to communicate. It was just more to kind of josh a little bit.
You came on in 27 and they were, say, in their 60s, and they were the immigrants. So they'd been in this country about 20 or 40 years,
yeah.
20 to 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd been speaking English right. for a while.
And most of them were raising families and had their own homes.
They had broken English.
Oh, broken, I hope to tell you.
Yeah. And the Scandinavian and German language and the English language all have the same root. Speak the same
mm-hmm.
than Australians.
Now, this Patty Morris, of course, who was one of the spokesmen for many, many, many years here, real Irishman. Irish is Patty's
name like that.
Even to the pipe.
Yeah. What did Patty look like?
He was quite a nice looking man. He was, I would say, about 5'8". Probably weighed about 160 pounds at the most. Bald, with
always had been bald.
To bald all my head. Recollection, and hair would is crop close to the head. And he had a great gift of the English language, you know, colored with his Irish semantics, and was a socialist student. Patty. Without a doubt, one of the finest speakers that I've ever heard. I mean, to get up off the bench and talk to you, you know, you just feel that he was rank and file and he knew what he was talking about. And I remember one time when we were talking before the 34th strike, and we didn't like certain things. By God, we're going to tie him up. And I remember Patty sitting smoking his pipe, and finally he got up and he said, "Okay, tie him up. But I'm telling you not to tie him up." And he said, "I know you're not going to listen to me. But," he said, "when you're tying the knots in the slack of your guts, don't be coming crying to me." Well, that made you kind of think a little bit. I mean, you didn't want to stay out that long, that you were going to be tying knots in the slack of your guts. So we took another look at it. But that was the way with Patty. He could really use colorful language and just bring you right up real quick. But the only thing that if you didn't agree with him, he could really flay your hide off too. And he didn't hesitate to do it. And in that way he made lots of enemies. Because, you know, don't tear the hide off from somebody in front of the membership and try to humiliate him, but Patty would do that. So he'd just deliberately do it. And so, but I always liked Patty. And of course, Patty was the district secretary. He was a guy that Bridges removed, he and Bill Lewis. But they did want to keep Patty, but Patty wouldn't stay. He took the march. And he went right back to work.
What about Jack Berkland? What did he look like?
Oh, he was a big man.
What was he like?
Jack was about 6'4", and he always weighed way in his 200s. And he originally was a shingle weaver. He lost a couple of fingers. That was always a trademark of the shingle weaver. And in turn then, in the early days of the longshoremen, say in 1912, I suppose, or in that area, Jack was a bartender. And they say that he could put his hand on the top of the bar and jump over the top and knock down four longshoremen just that fast. Just tougher than Billy Bedard. And he originally came out of the woods in Michigan, and in that area. And so from the shingle weavers and the bartender, well, then he became a longshoreman and Scandinavian, lots of Scandinavians, and he became a business agent and very active in the longshoremen. And he became the district secretary in about 1925 or 26. His predecessor was George Soule. So Jack was the business, and I can still see Jack. Any time he got ready to talk, he'd get up and he'd always have a chew of tobacco that he'd have to spit in his hand. See, that was to show them that you're a rank and file, you still were chewing tobacco. So he played the voice too.
Was he a good speaker as well?
Not too good, but he was real sincere. You never figured that Jack was going to sell you out or send you down the river. He wasn't a talker to Patty. But he and Patty were real close. In other words, Jack recognized that Patty had a tremendous amount of ability, and if there was any funds available, Patty was the organizer. Patty would get on a freight train and go to Portland, or he'd go there and go there. His wife worked. She was a legal secretary, Patty's wife. They had no children. So Patty was kind of footloose, and Patty was an ex-sailor. And of course, that made another key, too. So you see that it wasn't a question as much of nationality, it was just a question of, you know, the following that they had developed. I think a lot of guys look back at Jack and think, geez, any guy that put his hand and jump over a bar and knock down two longshoremen, I'm for him. But Jack was pretty good.
What about Bob Harden?
Well, Bob, he was a tall guy. He was about 6'4", about 175 pounds. Wiry. Ex-miner, ex-wobbly. Never married. Great student. I mean, he was always, you go up to his room and there's piles of papers of every description. Read. And he was a great talker. Most of the Wobblies were. I mean, they knew how to handle themselves and when to get on their feet. And of course, they were a great influence in the union, a great influence. And of course, they were thrilled, you know, when Ralph Chaplin came to the coast. And of course, they were thrilled again when Ralph Chaplin came to Tacoma. And those were good days.
Were there any other nationalities working in specific cargo?
No.
Just all mixed?
Yeah. Of course, with equal work opportunity, it would tend to be mixed. You just couldn't help it. But I think Lolly, his father was born in Italy. You know, so here you got another first generation.
Were there any antagonists? In some of my reading in other ports, there were antagonisms between different nationalities.
Well, there was no way to develop that here.
Why?
Well, on account of the selectivity that they had. The union decided who was going to be a member. Other ports, management decided who was going to be the member. I mean, in a fake call situation, they were the ones that decided.
And they would tend to play nationalities off against each other to create division.
They were the ones that selected the gangs. They were the ones that selected the hatchtenders. Hatchtenders in Tacoma, if you were a hatchtender, if the men didn't like you, you weren't a hatchtender very long. I mean, how could you be a hatchtender with no men? It just wasn't there. And how did you get to be a hatchtender? You had to have some skills and qualifications, and you had to be able to write, and you had to be able to get along with people, and you had to have a little knowledge and take care of the people that were working in safe conditions under you. You controlled that situation.
In Tacoma, the union selected the members by
That's
their
right.
work ethic.
That's right.
You've mentioned several people to interview, and I don't know their nationalities other than Tom Green, but...
Excuse me, we're still going.
Yeah.
Did you mention a German man to interview who would be aware of the German situation?
See, they're the old-time Germans are gone. There isn't too many old-timers left. Yeah. Out of Old Town, there's only 5 living. And 3 of those are in nursing homes. Like Bojack, he's the only one we ought to put his name down. I don't know, he never was very active, but he's one of the old-time...
What's his name?
Bojack, B-O-J-A-C-K. And Otness, he's 85. I just talked to him the other day.
O-T-N-E-S?
O-T, yeah. N-E-S, he's a Scandinavian. Those are the only, and there's only 2 standing on their 2 feet left out of Old Town.
Bojack is what nationality?
Oh, I would imagine he's Slavonian or something.
Yeah, Eastern European.
Yeah, we had Romanians and Slavonians, like George Miller. See, he was real active in the Union. And if you talk to Hartley, he'll tell you how Miller, the hours he spent helping the lumber and sawmill workers. Miller was active and was president of the Tacoma Longshoremen for many, many years. George mm-hmm. Miller.
Yes. Ed Harris also. He was.
There was two Ed Harris.
Big and little.
Big and little. Big Ed Harris was the one that was so active in the 34 strike. He was the one that organized the trip to Seattle on the 12th of May.
Well, he was already an old timer by then, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, that was Big Ed Harris. And then he quit in 36 as a dispatcher, and I took over as a dispatcher then. 36.
What about Dutch?
No, that was Dutch, but I don't I don't know if any of them are still around either. Of course, Canada knows, they'll know that more than I will. So.
French?
Well, there was quite a few Frenchmen.
Any that you can think of to suggest?
No.
Italians?
Well, Phil Lally.
It's Italian.
Yeah.
And blacks?
Of course, you got Canada. You know, he's part of this committee.
Is he black?
Is he black?
I've met
him. The only person she's met is Phil. Okay.
Well, when you see Canada, you ask yourself that.
Canada, and I should ask him about French too?
Ask him if they shall. Well, Canada, he's well versed in that. He's a great guy.
And any Irishman other than Tom Green? Another one.
No, there will be, though.
About English? Do you have many Englishmen working on the war front?
Yes, there were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was quite a few Englishmen. And they were quite active, too. Yeah.
Any ideas to interview?
No, they were all old-timers.
And you mentioned Romanians, Slavonians.
Yeah, well, that was George Miller. He was a... He's since passed away, but he was the president of the local effort many, many, many times. Gosh, I think he was the president for 8 or 9 years. They called him Trotsky.
Why did they call him Trotsky?
Well, they had to give him something. He wasn't commie, so then that was the next thing, Trotsky. I think it's in that...
It might have been, I probably...
No, I'm sure it is, Trotsky.
Any other...
And they called him Trotsky for years and years and years and years.
I think I asked you, and I've kind of forgotten already what you said, the pattern of migration of these nationalities who worked on the waterfront, they were primarily immigrants, you said, didn't
mm-hmm.
you?
Mm-hmm. I would say that better than 50% of the local. And the others were just migrant union men that had difficulties, blackballed.
Were there ever any Scandinavian newspapers?
Oh, sure.
The Tacoma, Tildindi, I don't know how to say
it. Oh, yeah, there was lots of Scandinavians. Even the Scandinavian societies were quite active.
I was wondering, where are these newspapers?
I suppose you could ask up there in K Street, up there at that Walla Halla Hall. You know, they still are active in Scandinavian societies.
What?
You know, the Paul Sandergren, his dad was a publisher, and he's formerly the editor of the Labor Advocate, and he lives down on a canal. Paul Sandergren. You know, you just find out where he lives, and he could tell you.
His father was the editor of the Labor Advocate.
No, he was the editor of the Scandinavian newspapers. And Paul was the editor of the Labor Advocate.
How do you spell his name?
S-A-N-D-E-R-G-R-E-N.
D-E-R-G-R-E-N.
Yeah.
If we were able to locate some of these Scandinavian newspapers from the early times, would there be people who could read them?
Oh, sure. Sure, right there in that same group.
In the Valhalla Hall?
Sure. Sure.
Would there be any union men who would be interested in working on this committee who could read them?
I doubt it. Most likely out of Parkland.
Who printed these newspapers? They were their own publishing company, weren't they?
Yeah, I think they had their own presses. I'm sure they did.
If I wanted to try to locate some of these newspapers, would I go to Normanna Hall, or?
Well, I think that I'd try to get a hold of Paul Sandergren first.
And talk to him.
Yeah, and he lives down there in the canal.
On the canal, what
yeah.
canal?
Well, which canal? I don't know whether it's Belfair or probably he's got a telephone through that Belfair exchange. And he'd be more than gracious. Paul was quite a newspaper man.
Mm-hmm.
He graduated from Northwestern.
Why do you suppose so many after 1900, why do you suppose so many Scandinavians came here?
Well, you know, what happens is that when one gets here, he's got about 9 cousins back in the old country. And they send transportation funds and they bring them out. My people settled in Wisconsin. And geez, by the time they got through with it, I guess there's thousands of them. Scary to death.
So your people weren't direct migrants?
No.
But you think the majority of the Scandinavians here were?
Right. See, my dad come west with the railroad. Come west with the Great Northern, and then they had the strike in 1898. He got as far as Montana. And then he came west with the idea of going to the gold fields. And they were building the South Tacoma shops at that time, and he was a machinist, and he knew somebody there, and first thing you know, he went to work. And then, everything else, he got married and raised a family.
I interviewed the commanding officer at McCord Air Force Base some months ago, and he was commenting on the tremendous work ethic of the people in this area. And you have said the same thing. And I wondered if you have any reason that you think that's true here.
I don't know.
Do you think it's because they're Scandinavians who work so hard?
I don't think so. maybe it's the climate.
What else is there to do in the wintertime, especially?
No, there's. But it is true that the climate has a great deal to do with it. You feel more like it.
I know it's true. Southern California has one of the highest absenteeism rates of any part of the country, mm-hmm. because it's so easy to spend the day at the beach.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a little more, or has been a little more freedom here too, where people have tended to own their own homes, and you could get out a little recreation, a little more. There's a little more openness. I don't think it feels as suppressed as probably jammed up in some of these other communities. But I don't think that race has anything to do with putting on a day's worth. I never saw that.
All right, well, I think we've, one thing, I'm almost out of tapes, Tiny, so we gotta quit.
Yeah.